Wyoming Public Media, this is Human Nature. Real stories where humans and our habitat meet. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Erin Jones. For many of us, animals are fascinating. They're cute, they're scary, they're majestic, they're mysterious.
So today, we'll hear four stories about animal encounters. We'll begin with the most elusive one of them all.
An animal so elusive, its existence isn't even certain.
His conclusion after looking at it was that it is definitely primate hair, and it's not human. It's also not from any known primate.
That unknown primate would be Bigfoot, or more precisely, Sasquatch. That's the Native American word, meaning wild man. To record this story, we traveled on dirt roads to the foot of Wyoming's Wind River Range, where Sasquatch is reported to live.
It's also where John Mindzinski lives. In 1967, John was a college biology student. That's when a magazine article came out that everyone in his department started passing around.
It was on Sasquatch with photographs, stills from movie footage. The people involved in the sighting, the cameraman and the horse packer who was with him, seemed to be credible. Very interesting, but I can't say I believed in the subject at that time.
Like most biologists, John was skeptical about Sasquatch. After college, he got a job as a warden for the Wyoming Game and Fish Department. He patrolled the backcountry on horseback for weeks at a time. Usually, the only people he ran into were sheep herders. They had their own Sasquatch legends.
Their term for it amongst all the sheep herders that worked in the Wind Rivers was the old man. And they had stories about them stealing sheep occasionally and running off with them and spooking the horses.
One night, John was camped out alone in the backcountry.
It was a forest camp, and something came by that was breathing at a very slow rate, and I thought it was a bear. That would be the obvious thing to think, because it came to a bacon stain I had in the tent. It was a Forest Service tent that I got out of the warehouse, and somebody had spilled bacon grease all over the side of it. So I was sort of anticipating a bear problem. And the moon was coming up in the east. It was a wall tent, so it was tall, taller than I was. So it was over 6 foot two. And there was a really nice, perfect shadow of something coming into this bacon stain and poking its nose into it, probably licking it. I assumed it was a bear, and I had a .357 Magnum handgun with me. I had that out. So this thing was poking its nose in the side of my tent, and I hit it with the back of my hand and made a yelping sound. And it ran off, but it didn't go very far. It went about 20 feet, and I could hear it breathing in these pines. Thick enough you don't walk through it comfortably, but it'd be a great place to hide. So this thing was in there and breathing, and then 40 minutes later or so, it came back and did the same thing, and I hit it with my hand again, and it ran back. And for half hour or 45 minutes, I could still hear it breathing back there. Very resonant, deep breathing like an elk. I would say just imagine somebody snoring, very low-pitched snoring, both on the in-breathing and the out-breathing. It came back a third time, and this time... this shadow or the silhouette of it in the moonlight, which was almost a full moon that night. So it was a very good shadow. There was no wind blowing. It was standing up and was over the top of the tent and cast a shadow. Over it, I can see an arm swinging and it was walking on two legs. And then it stopped alongside of the tent and there was an indentation in the wall of the tent. So I hit that indentation. And this time I hit something hard instead of something soft. So I'm pretty sure I hit a kneecap. And this hand came down over the top of the tent. So I saw the silhouette of a hand that was not the size of mine, but it had an opposed thumb like a human hand, not at all like a bear. And the hand was twice the width of mine with an open palm. It was well over a foot wide from little finger to thumb. And it was hairy. You could see the silhouette of hair between the fingers. Anyway, it fell over on the tent and had me pinned down by my legs. And then it got up and ran off behind those trees again. So now my tent was demolished, and I crawled out of it and built the fire that was in the fire ring in front of the tent. And just sat there and watched where the breathing was coming from, because I wanted to see what this was. And then I started to doze off. I woke up to the sound of something hitting the ground, and I looked up and didn't see anything. And then I saw a pine cone get lobbed from where the breathing was coming from in my direction. And in the next 3/4 of an hour, there were about 20 to 25 pine cones that got thrown at me. More correctly, I think they were being thrown at the campfire, because a lot of them landed in the fire and around it. And the whole time I could hear that breathing.
Eventually, the creature left. John couldn't hear it breathing anymore. In the morning, John looked for tracks, but the ground was thick with pine duff, and there were no tracks to be seen.
When I came down, I told my boss about it. He got up, closed the door to his office, and we had a private conversation, which basically was about other sightings that people have had in that area that summer. At that point, he suggested that although the Forest Service couldn't justify paying anybody to really investigate an animal that doesn't exist, there were reports coming into that office, and it made the newspapers nationwide at that time, 1972. The local ranger was getting requests from big game hunters who wanted to come out and find out the location of the last sighting so that they could collect the ultimate trophy. That put the ranger in a precarious position of, well, what if this is a guy in a monkey suit and he gets killed? The Forest Service is implicated in the murder because they told the person where to go hunt for it. So on that justification, I was asked to go and follow up on some of these sightings and get the full report and try to come up with physical evidence and find out if it's a guy in a monkey suit.
John spent the next year interviewing locals who said they'd seen Sasquatch. He also looked for physical evidence and finally found some. A hunter claimed to have shot a Sasquatch. Injured, it ran away.
It left some hair on the ground. I took it to the Game and Fish Department, who had a forensic veterinarian. All he could tell me officially was that the hair did not belong to a species native to Wyoming. But unofficially, he said, primate hair has a distinctive look to it, and this has that look.
The Game and Fish veterinarian recommended John take the hair to the University of Wyoming for a primatologist's opinion.
He said that he was not an expert in hair, but he would send it to the most notable expert in primate hair in the world, which was Walter Berkby. And he was a primatologist who was known for his expertise in primate hair identification. And, as George told me before he sent the sample off, should warn you that this man also has been outspoken on the subject of Bigfoot. And he would love to have any suspect hairs from a Bigfoot to be sent to him so he could disprove this myth. So he ended up with the hair, and his conclusion after looking at it was that it is definitely primate hair and it's not human. It's also not from any known primate. So that's the reason I'm still interested. Most of the Game and Fish people I worked with my initial sighting were very interested in the subject and did follow up on it, but they did it very quietly and would deny any interest in the subject officially or publicly because it affects your job opportunities.
Why did you decide to be public about it?
Well, I think because I was young and ignorant when this happened. And I, in my naive state, thought that scientists would be interested in this, especially after the hair sample turned up to be an unknown species. You know, this might be the most interesting wildlife project to come along. But it turned out it's not that way. I was threatened with my job by a higher up in the Game and Fish Department, as was the head veterinarian for Game and Fish at that time, and another person who expressed interest in it, who I won't name. We were threatened with our jobs if our names were ever even connected with the word Bigfoot in the future. The other people I know that were interested in this subject never talked about it again openly. But I made the decision that I could never work for the Game and Fish Department because of that.
Do
John kept following up on reported sightings. As he asked people about their experiences, he found many were reluctant to share their stories. But some people were willing to talk. One woman's story stuck with John ever since.
She's a musician and would learn her repertoire in the mountains by going hiking. And she was on one of her summer hiking tours of Colorado wilderness. Well, she'd stay out for a month at a time and just camp and practice her flute. And one time she was practicing in a tent and thought she heard a stick break behind her tent. So she got her pepper spray out, thinking it was possibly a bear, crawled out in front of her tent and had to look over the top of her tent to see what it was behind it. And she was face to face with a very large, hairy, human-like face, which she described as a human face, but with a body that was completely covered in hair, except for the circle around the eyes, nose, and mouth. It was about between 7.5 and 8 feet tall. It had a very compassionate look on its face, so she said it was a confusing time for her. She was not necessarily afraid as much as awestruck by the sight of something that human-like and that large. And she feels it was drawn in by her music. She had a very close and good sighting, 12 feet away, and it lasted a long time. She thought close to a minute, where they just stared at each other, which is a very long time for Sasquatch sighting. And then it turned around, and she said when it turned around, she realized it was not human, at least not the way we define human. Turned around very gracefully for something that weighed close to 1,000 pounds. And it was so graceful in its movement, she knew that a human couldn't move that way. And then when it moved aside, another one was behind it, which was smaller, and she took to be the mate, the female. And it stared at her for a long time, too. And then it wheeled around also gracefully, and they both walked to the edge of the meadow and stood next to each other, looked back at her. And she couldn't move, she said, for quite a few minutes after that, because she just didn't know what happened to her. So she was walking back and forth, pondering this whole experience. And she'd picked up a branch off of a spruce tree and was just kind of working it with her fingers as something to do while she was concerned about this sighting and what it meant.
The musician fiddled with the branch for a while. It was unique, with two smaller branches coming off the main stem. Then she set it down. It was time to leave anyway, so she packed up her camp and spent the day hiking back to her car. She arrived late, so she spent the night near a picnic table.
And then in the morning she got up, and on a boulder next to the picnic table was this same branch she had been twirling around.
Listening to people's stories and reading more about Sasquatch, John found that the stories had patterns. Leaving tokens, like the spruce branch was one. Sasquatch apparently likes to do that. But another pattern emerged. Some stories told of Sasquatch capturing humans and keeping them. There's a report of this happening to a man in British Columbia.
So he lived with a family of Sasquatch in British Columbia for about a week.
As a pet?
As a pet. The children played with him, the young Sasquatches. Fascinating story.
The multiple sightings and reports, the scientific and cultural ridicule, none of this is new historically. John points out several animals have been sneered at before being accepted by science. One is the okapi, an African creature that looks like a cross between a giraffe and a zebra. It's rare, but it does exist.
Another animal is the gorilla. It was not accepted. Several hundred years went by where people described seeing gorillas and drew pictures of them. And the Royal Academy in England just didn't accept it and ridiculed people who went down looking for an ape, basically. But it was described as an animal with a human face. And there were lots of paranormal associated stories to go along with it. that these things could get into your dreams, and they could control your mind, and they were part man and part beast. And now we know and accept that lowland gorillas and mountain gorillas exist. The paranormal aspects have gone away. But people were afraid of even looking for these things. It's only a matter of time before Sasquatch is discovered in the same sort of way that the gorillas were. So what do you do with that? You just say, I'm not going to believe in it. We'll put those in a drawer and never look at them again. Or I believe if you're a true scientist, you open the drawer and you start investigating.
What is it about Sasquatch that captures people and captures maybe their imagination?
Well, I think many of us are fascinated with the unknown. And this is one of those subjects which is almost entirely unknown, except for stories, anecdotal stories, dating back, I might add, thousands and thousands of years amongst the Native Americans.
How can there be such a big species, you know, 7 feet tall, that's still undiscovered in 2016?
Well, that's hard one to, that's one of the mysteries. It's a hard one to answer. We can make guesses. The most common guess the anthropologists give is that we're dealing with an intelligent being that's probably very human-like and more skilled at evading its enemies than we are, because it actually lives in the woods. That's one answer. And number two answer probably has to go with it, is that we're dealing with a very low population size. So what if there are only five in the Wind River Range, but they happen to be intelligent and very skilled at avoiding their enemies? Number one enemy would probably be human beings or maybe grizzlies. I think there's this fear that there's something there that we can't ever really completely know, kind of like a ghost. I think people poo-poo ghost stories, you know, unless they've seen one. Commonly because they're human, but you can't really, they're not tangible. You can't really grasp it, or you can't understand it completely. And for some reason, that makes people fearful. I think approaching it, though, as a scientist, you see it differently as, you know, everything in science starts out that way. You don't have to fear it. It starts out as an unknown, and then you systematically look for more information until you can document it and understand it. The fact that this particular species resembles a human, and we haven't identified it yet, makes people anxious, and I'm not sure why.
And you'd like to maybe be captured by one?
Well, in a friendly way, yeah. I've lived in the woods enough. I have maybe a little overconfident that I could eventually escape. Maybe not, but I would rather do that and document it than fire a gun at one.
Our storyteller was John Mindzinski. We've got a video of him showing a cast of a Sasquatch foot at our website, humannaturepodcast.org. And it really is a really big foot.
Up next, how birds solved the problem of getting camera film across a river.
He sewed these little jock straps for these pigeons where the film was supposed to be placed.
You're listening to Human Nature.
You're listening to Human Nature. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Erin Jones. This next story is about one man's quest to get photographs from one side of the river to the other.
Turns out, it's more difficult than it sounds.
These days we have it easy with cameras on our smartphones, but this story happened in the 80s when cameras used film. Charlie Thomas was a guide on the Snake River for a whitewater rafting company in Jackson, Wyoming. And his boss, Rod, hit on the idea of selling floatographs to customers. Get it? Float plus photograph, as in pictures of people rafting.
The idea was to get the film back to town before the customers showed up on the bus, so that when they stepped off the bus, voila, there were their pictures for sale.
The problem is the best spot to take the pictures was on the bank of the river opposite the road. And this isn't exactly a lazy river either. The exciting parts of the Snake are big rapids, and that's where you want to be for the dramatic photograph. But Charlie's boss wasn't deterred.
And initially, he had all sorts of different schemes. He tried having the photographers cast the film across the river with a fishing rod, which didn't work. They couldn't get it all the way across. And then he tried having them tie it to an arrow and shoot it across the river,
where a motorcyclist was waiting to speed the film back to town.
And they kept losing the film that way, too. And so finally, then Rod strung a wire across the river, and they would put the film on a little pulley, and it would go, across on this wire. But then one day during high water, one of the other rafts coming down the river snagged the cable and took the whole thing down. So that also failed. Then he decided that the photographers would load up the film in this little plastic bag, this little floaty yellow bag. And when we came down, they would snap the pictures and then heave the film out into the river. And we were supposed to somehow get the customers. These were U-paddle trips. And the people were paddling the raft. And we were supposed to get the people to turn the boat around and paddle back upstream to try to save this film that was floating down in the middle of the rapids. And needless to say, it wasn't working out very well.
Let's talk about how ridiculous this is. Your raft is barreling through whitewater rapids. Now you need to turn your raft around and retrieve a floating film canister. So Charlie remembers his frustrated boss gathering together the raft guides.
I remember one day Rod coming down, and he's angry with us because we'd lost yet another thing of film. And he's like, "What is the number one most important thing on the river?" And we're like, safety? And he's, "No, it's the film, make sure the film gets." And so none of it was working very well. And photographs, had a pretty bad record because mostly the people weren't able to see their pictures. So he didn't have that captive audience.
But even after all those setbacks, Charlie's boss was set on this idea of photographs. And eventually he hit on the solution, but it was an expensive, complicated solution. Racing pigeons.
He was going to put the film on the racing pigeons. So all the money started going into these pigeons. And he built this pigeon coop. At the time, they had this building moratorium. I think the highest building in Jackson could only be 2 stories high. But Rod somehow managed to build on top of another building this pigeon coop that was 3 stories up. Towering over everything in Jackson was Rod's pigeon coop, and he spent oodles of money training these pigeons, and he took them to California so they could have a warm place where they could practice all the pigeoning, and he had these schemes for the pigeons. He would starve them of food or of sex, and they would be so they would be motivated to fly back to the pigeon coop faster. And he sewed these little jock straps for these pigeons where the film was supposed to be placed, and he was ready for the pigeons to make their maiden voyage.
So the day finally came for the pigeons to fly the film from the photographer on the far side of the river back to the raft outfitter.
The photographers took these pigeons down to the river, and they took their pictures, and they put the film in the pigeon and flew it, sent it up in the air, and the pigeon just beeline towards Jackson, and these things were fast. They would go like 60 miles an hour. They easily beat the bus back there. The people, as soon as they stepped off the bus, there was their picture. Sales were just roaring. It was a huge success. Everybody was excited. And then...
And then some pigeons didn't make it back to town with the film, which is kind of weird because the pigeon film delivery system had been working so well. And it's not like they were getting off track and arriving late. They just weren't showing up at all. So Charlie's boss started to investigate why his pigeons were disappearing. And he discovered that the U.S. Forest Service had just begun reintroducing peregrine falcons along the Snake River.
Racing pigeons are the fastest birds out there. Eagles can't keep up with them. The only thing that can catch a racing pigeon is a peregrine falcon.
And this is where a story about getting film across a river turns into a story about private enterprise versus big government.
Rod, he was of the old school, where he felt that the government had nothing to do with private industry, and he felt completely justified in protecting his interests against the government. And so Rod got himself a shotgun, and he went down there, and he decided he was going to protect his pigeons against those peregrine falcons. Well, the Forest Service didn't agree.
And for all his gun waving, Rod didn't actually shoot any falcons. Which is a good thing, because at the time, the peregrine falcon was listed as an endangered species. And that's the challenge of operating a business within federally managed lands. Sometimes conservation and profits butt heads. And in this case, conservation won out.
But Rod's pigeons did continue to carry the film and were successful for many years with only a small attrition rate to peregrine falcons.
So the pigeons and the falcons had to coexist. And although the peregrine falcon's favorite meal is medium-sized birds, most of the film still made it back to town. Decades later, you can still get a photograph from your next rafting adventure. But the film won't be flown by a racing pigeon wearing a tiny jock strap. Today, it's pixels flying through the air instead of pigeons. Our storyteller was former Snake River raft guide Charlie Thomas.
Coming up, how a relaxing swim in the ocean turned into a terrifying experience.
I was kicking wildly to get it off, but it just bit down harder. And so I'm screaming with my arms outstretched. It's got me, it's got me.
That's next on Human Nature.
It's Human Nature from Wyoming Public Media. I'm Erin Jones.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. On today's show, we're hearing about animal encounters.
And in this next story, we'll meet an animal. A big animal. With a PR problem. Let's face it, sharks are scary.
So scary, they can turn the most dedicated nature lover against them. Ask Debbie Salamone. Debbie worked as an environmental reporter at the Orlando Sentinel.
I mean, I covered manatees. I wrote about the Everglades. And I did do a lot of stories about development and how development would be impacting the community environmentally.
How fulfilling was that work to you?
Oh, it was extremely fulfilling. I mean, when you feel like you're making a difference, it really is just the ultimate for your work. I mean, you really hope that you can leave a lasting impact.
And like any good Floridian, Debbie loved the beach.
I spent most of my upbringing at the beach. I loved the ocean, bouncing around in the waves, and I never really gave sharks a second thought.
That is until one day in August of 2004.
It was one of those really hot, muggy, sunny summer days where you just want to get into the water. Well, I was there late in the afternoon and swimming. But in Florida, as everybody knows, an afternoon thunderstorm can roll in at any time. So it started to get a little bit cloudy and overcast. And then I could hear a little bit of thunder in the distance. And I thought, oh, okay, it's time to get out. Because you certainly don't want to get struck by lightning. So I turned around to walk toward the shore. And then all of a sudden, this big fish just jumped out of the water right next to me. And as soon as I saw that fish, I thought, uh-oh, that's really not a good sign. All I could feel were all of these slimy, slithering bodies going around my legs and in between my legs. And then the next thing you know, a shark was just on the back of my foot. And I was kicking wildly to get it off, but it just bit down harder. I couldn't tell what was happening because the waves were churning up the sand and I couldn't see anything, even though I was only in waist-deep water about 50 feet off the shore. I thought, my gosh, you know, I could be in the middle of this feeding frenzy. I don't know how many sharks are even down there. It just felt like there was all kinds of things down there going on. I just couldn't see anything. All I knew is I just wanted to get out of there. And so at this point now, I'm panicking. I'm realizing what the situation is, that there is actually a shark on the back of my foot. And so I'm screaming with my arms outstretched. It's got me, it's got me. And I don't really know when it let go. I just couldn't tell. I thought it was back there eating my foot. So I'm trying to get to shore, but every step I take is becoming more difficult because the water's getting more shallow and I can't put any pressure on my right foot. The front of my leg is now folding over the top of my foot. And I knew something was just horribly wrong. And so my companion there, he grabbed me by my hands and just started dragging me through the water and then sort of picked me up and then dragged me some more. And eventually I collapsed onto the sand and I only had the courage to look back once. I could see my foot just going in different directions. It was just completely mangled and shredded. There were just big hunks of flesh kind of hanging off. There was all this blood staining the sand and washing out with the waves. And I just looked around and I stared down at the sand. Unbelievably, this nurse was taking a walk and she came along and she saw all this blood and she heard the screaming and she jumped into action right away. She grabbed my beach towel and wrapped up my foot and meanwhile now the storm is coming and it's the thunder's really loud and the lightning is cracking and it's windy and the tide's coming in, so we have to keep crawling on one knee and two hands to try and get up out of the water while she's holding onto my foot, keeping it elevated.
Eventually, the rescue workers showed up and took Debbie to the hospital. But her worries weren't over, because Debbie was also a ballroom dancer, and she loved that just as much as her journalism work.
What did you love about ballroom dancing?
I just felt like ballroom dancing was a great expression of emotion that you could just fly across the floor and be creative in the way you move, and you know, you could just dance with reckless abandon. Especially after spending a week in the newsroom, you really need that kind of thing. When I was in the emergency room, I really was afraid I was going to be permanently damaged. Of course, I was screaming, you know, I'm a ballroom dancer, I'm a ballroom dancer, you know, please make sure you fix me right. The Achilles actually was just completely severed, and so then it popped back up into my leg so that the surgeon was able to reach in there and pull it down and reattach it to the bottom part that was still in the foot.
Whoa. That's crazy. Wow.
Yeah. So anyway, I got out of the hospital after a few days. I come home And I'm sitting on the couch now with my leg elevated in this huge bandages. And it took a long time to be able to walk. Walking's one thing. Dancing was going to be another thing because that really requires so much of the foot. So I really was very worried all that time that I'm sitting here in the house. And in my closet, there are my beautiful ballroom dance gowns and my high-heeled shoes. And I'm thinking to myself, will I ever get into those shoes and dresses again?
Worry turned to doubt, and doubt turned to anger.
As time goes on, I became more angry at the shark. You know, how dare this shark, especially me, the environmental journalist who's all about conservation and making sure that, you know, all the animals are taken care of and the land's taken care of and the ocean, you know, is conserved. Here I'm the one who ends up being attacked by the very thing I'm trying to protect. I started questioning my whole dedication to environmental conservation. And I can even remember being driven to the doctor one day and looking all around me at all the pavement and the roads, and I thought to myself, you know, pavement is good. You know, pavement's not so bad. And at that point, really, if there was a proposal to like pave over half the ocean, I really would have been fine with that. I was really frustrated and angry. I remember making plans, thinking, okay, next August, on the year's anniversary of this attack, I am going to go out and eat shark steak in revenge because I'm going to be on the top of the food chain again. So anyway, here I am, just like sitting here with my leg up and I can't move. I'm scooting around the house on my behind just to get something out of the refrigerator.
Then, for Memorial Day, the editors at the Orlando Sentinel asked Debbie to write a story for the beginning of beach season. The pitch? Going back into the water for the first time since she'd been bitten by the shark.
So I went back to the beach, and I met up with a nurse who had helped me. We held hands, and we walked into the ocean together, and I can't think of a better way to go back in than to go with her. It was really very... It was very meaningful, and I felt at peace with the ocean. I knew that I could be comfortable there again. It was a way for me to let go of the anger, the frustration, the fear. I could have that relationship again with nature that I had so valued through most of my life and felt that I almost lost. Sharks aren't by nature coming to eat you. Most shark attacks are a case of mistaken identity, which is exactly what happened to me. The fish that jumped out of the water was a lot smarter than I was. It got out of the way, and there was my foot looking awfully fish-like. And it happened to end up in the shark's mouth, and it was just being in the wrong place at the wrong time. With these shark attacks being so rare, about 80 people worldwide each year attacked by a shark, why on earth did it happen to me? And so I'm thinking and thinking, and I felt like there had to be some kind of a reason. And I felt like maybe this was really just a test. That's what I decided to see it as, a test of my commitment to environmental conservation. And if I could overcome this animosity toward the sharks, then it would really prove that I could be an ocean advocate and that I could be an environmental advocate.
And Debbie started to realize she was not so much a victim of sharks, but rather a victim of bad luck. Now Debbie works with the Pew Charitable Trusts in their Shark Conservation Initiative.
I know that I can make a difference. I know that I can use my experience to get the word out that sharks are in terrible trouble. I mean, 100 million sharks are killed each year, mostly for their fins to make shark fin soup. They take a shark out of the water, slice off the fins, and sometimes dump the animal back into the water while it's still alive, where it drowns or bleeds to death. and about half of all species are headed for extinction. So sharks just have this terrible PR problem. And they got these big rows of teeth, and to a lot of people, they are not attractive at all. And they're very scary looking.
Are they attractive to you?
Yeah, you know, they've actually kind of grown on me, because I didn't necessarily think they were too attractive, but yeah, they have kind of grown on me. And now that I know more about them and what they're able to do, and I do see a beauty in them. And these animals are in need of someone like me to speak up for them. They really need help.
And not just from Debbie. She's recruited shark attack survivors from all over.
A lot of them lost arms and legs. They almost died. Their experiences are 1,000 times worse than mine, and yet they are shark advocates. And that is just amazing to me that they all agreed to be part of the group, considering what they went through. They wanted to make something really positive out of something that was very tragic.
They've even presented at the UN and the U.S. Capitol.
We're a really big hit wherever we go, because when you see a bunch of people without arms and legs walking around in matching t-shirts that say Shark Attack Survivor for Shark Conservation, we really get people to pay attention.
So in the end, the shark goes from attacker to victim, and Debbie's anger has turned to advocacy. She's even dancing again.
Can you tell me about the first time you went back on the ballroom floor?
Oh, it was just so wonderful to be back on the dance floor. I can't even describe the elation to be able to do what I loved again, to have that freedom, be able to move. I was so grateful. I can't even tell you. And even to this day, I'll walk through just a parking lot going into the grocery store, and I'll think to myself, so happy I can just walk.
Our storyteller was shark attack survivor Debbie Salamone. You can learn more about her work at pewtrusts.org.
And you can see a photo of Debbie dressed up for ballroom dancing at our website, humannaturepodcast.org.
Coming up, how animals comforted a woman who was worried about the future.
I mean, it was digging for so long, and it was so special to be able to see that and to really just be like, wow, this is incredible.
That's ahead as Human Nature continues. Listening to Human Nature. I'm Erin Jones.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. For our final story about animal encounters, we'll hear about a woman who was worried about the changes to come.
Amy works for a conservation agency in the West.
There's something really relaxing and really soothing about being in an area that's totally untouched by humans. It's something that, you know, is not common anymore. We don't have a lot of wild spaces. So those little wild spaces we get, those are so sacred and they're so special, to a chance for us to unwind, disconnect from, you know, all the hectic day-to-day things that happen and all that's gone. And that's so special to give that opportunity for people to just totally lose themselves and be just one with nature.
We're not saying Amy's last name or exactly where she works because she's worried that what she's about to say could affect her job. On November 9th, the day after Donald Trump was elected president, Amy headed into work.
I have a pretty long drive through a very rural area, and I remember it was really a beautiful day. It was really sunny and the sky was really bright blue, and it's hard to really enjoy it. I was feeling not so optimistic. when I pulled into the office and got in, everyone just kind of had this sad look on their face and stopped in the doorway of the first office and kind of just looked at everybody. And we didn't really say anything, but we knew what we were feeling. And we all were really tired because a lot of us had actually woke up in the middle of the night to check our phones to see who had won. And we sat around with our coffee and looked at each other and just, we all really couldn't believe that it had happened. And we were really concerned about a lot of things. We were concerned about, you know, all the hate that we've heard for the diversity of America that makes us so special. And we were really concerned for those people. And we're all really concerned too about, you know, the safety of our jobs and all the regulations for, like, the environment would just go away. There's so much public land, and that's something that really makes, I think, the West a special place. And just to imagine that all having development on it and industry on it, we had been really enjoying the last 8 years. There's been so much great movement towards a better planet, you know, a better place for everybody, and that was gone. After we got it out of our system about thinking about things, we try to think of ways to carry on the day. And one of the things we do every week is we have safety sessions, and one of the individuals who was scheduled to do it was trying to think of something to do, and he thought, oh, well, I'll do it on depression. So he was going through things, and we found things on, you know, just little things like go outside, spend time with friends, and, you know, just the typical things that people suggest for depression. And we even found something online like how to immigrate to Canada, and we thought that was kind of funny. We were trying to joke around, it's like, oh, don't worry about it, it's gonna be great, it's gonna be huge, just pulling off some one-liners that have amused us through Trump's campaign. And so we all came to the conclusion that it was a good day to do some field work, and also might be a good day to break things up and just kind of look for something to do outside and remember why we are here and just feel a lot better getting some fresh air.
One of the things Amy does every week is monitor a prairie dog colony near her office.
And I walk about a mile and I count every prairie dog that I see. And they're doing various things. They're eating, they're wrestling around, they're just communicating, and they're pretty entertaining to watch. So it's really kind of a nice experience. But we're really looking at how many prairie dogs there are and if the population is healthy or not.
So I imagine you've gotten to know the prairie dog communities fairly well.
Yeah, I definitely have spent a lot of time. I've been monitoring them for about 2 years now, and I swear they have a special call for me. When I monitor the prairie dogs, I have this giant scope and binoculars and a book bag, and standing there in their business, and it almost sounds like they're kind of hyperventilating when I'm around, and it's just a very fast call. And so I always joke around that it's my special call that that I'm around, and they know that I'm there, alerting that everyone else that here comes the lady with a spotting scope. So we went out, and I went out with one of my other colleagues who I normally do prairie dog monitoring with, and we were walking a quarter mile to the site where we do our prairie dog monitoring, and we just were kind of quiet, and we're observing the scenery, just thinking about the election, really, really still can't believe it, in shock. And we stop at our first stop and assemble the spotting scopes and get ready to begin counting the prairie dogs, and I heard a flutter of wings brush behind my back, and in the wintertime you can hear things so clearly, there's not that much sound out there, and I could just hear his little wings flying, and he's going from brush to brush to brush. And so I turned my head to look at it, and it was a black-capped chickadee, and they're very curious little birds, and this little chickadee was flicking his head all around looking at us and checking us out and just kind of interacting with us in a very unusual way that a chickadee normally wouldn't do. And so we kind of smiled at that and thought nothing of it. And I turned to look at my colleague and I felt the chickadee fly and land on top of my hat. And I could hear his little toenails dancing around, moving around, and he was moving all around my hat. And it was just the craziest thing to feel that and to, it's like, well, there's a bird on my head. This is really random. And then that chickadee flew from my head to my colleague's feet and just bounced around his feet for a little bit on his shoes. And then he flew away off into the brush. And we really couldn't believe that that was such an unusual experience. And it really lightened us up. We were really laughing and just thought it was the funniest thing. As we walked along, we could still see two little chickadees kind of following us and looking at us. And we're distracted by this chickadee, and a great horned owl flies out in front of us and was just majestic. Yeah, and then it gets crazier that in the middle of our count, we had done one section, and we moved on to the next section, and we're scanning through the colony with our spotting scopes, and I'm like, whoa, look at that. That's a badger out at 10 o'clock in the morning. It was full on out, digging up a prairie dog burrow, and I mean, he was just dig, and then he would go right back underground, and then come back up, run to another burrow, and like push the earth back down into a hole. So we were seeing like attempted predation, which was so cool.
Do they normally eat prairie dogs?
Yeah, they do. Our prairie dog colony is not that big. It's about 40 acres. So this badger has been in the colony since I've been there, and I've never got to see it. I've always seen the burrows. I've never actually seen it.
You said that it was unusual for the badger to be out in the middle of the day. Are they nocturnal? Is that why that's unusual?
Yeah, they're out during the night mostly, and they come out occasionally during the day, but it's not something you commonly would see. I mean, it was digging for so long, and it was so special to be able to see that and to really just be like, wow, this is incredible. Like, this is an amazing thing that we got to see today.
Did you feel a little bit like Snow White?
I did with the chickadee. Yeah, I definitely felt like my little animal friends were there chasing me around.
Do you think that the animals sensed your sorrow, sensed your mood?
We kind of thought that they might have. I mean, the whole experience was just really uplifting. You know, we really felt really good. And we're like, this has to mean something. Like, you know, like it was just one of those things that was like encouraging almost. Like, were the animals trying to just tell us to just, it'll be okay. Like, you know, you're doing good things and keep doing good things and don't give up. And it was almost like their little message, because they were just acting so unusual and just really, they really cheered us up. And it's something that, you know, still to this day, as you know, we're coming up to the actual inauguration, it's just still gives me hope. It's like, okay, like those little things happen and they give you that, you know, encouragement that it's going to be okay. And there's something we can do. We can still fight for the environment. That's always going to be there.
Our storyteller Amy plans to start a compost. She says the animals have her thinking more about the small things she can do to make the world a better place.
Speaking of small things, we have an adorable video of her prairie dog colony at our website, humannaturepodcast.org.
While you're there, you can also listen to more stories about human experiences in nature and subscribe to our podcast. And for another great animal encounter story, be sure to check out episode 11, Hoofprints on the Heart.
The show is produced by Aaron Jones.
And by Caroline Ballard.
Our senior producer is Micah Schweitzer. Anna Rader is our digital producer. The theme song is by Caught a Ghost.
Human Nature is a production of Wyoming Public Media. It's human.